Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It is my distinct pleasure and privilege to welcome you all to the first biannual John R. LaMontagne Memorial Lecture, which honors my former colleague and dear friend to many of us, John LaMontagne, who, as many of you know, served as NIRD's deputy director from 1998 until his untimely death in November of 2004. It was 18 months ago that we mourned John's death, but at that time, in the discussions of John's life, we began to celebrate his life, and a most extraordinary life. What we're doing here today is to continue and to further the celebration of the life of this most extraordinary human being. John LaMontagne came to the NIH in 1976 as the Institute's first influenza program officer, and it was in this context that he got his, as we call it, his baptism of fire during the year of the now famous or infamous swine flu episode. Throughout his career, he dedicated his infectious diseases expertise to a number of areas, ranging from HIV/AIDS to tuberculosis to malaria, to the vaccines to combat childhood diseases, respiratory diseases, diarrheal diseases, and even biodefense. His leadership and his unwavering commitment to the fight against emerging and reemerging infectious diseases earned him international recognition, numerous awards, and the widespread admiration of his colleagues. For those of you who knew John, you remember that John had been agitating about emerging and reemerging infections, particularly influenza, as well as the threat of bioterror attacks long, long before it became fashionable and we had TV shows about them. In fact, when I first became director of NIRD in 1984, John was in the Division of Microbiology and Infectious Diseases, and almost all of our conversations were centered around the importance of our being prepared from a scientific and public health standpoint for emerging and reemerging infectious diseases. And when he became my deputy in 1998, spending every day of every week about 10 feet from him across the office space, he used to remind me of this virtually consistently and constantly. And he was, as usual, right. But that's really not the most important component of John LaMontagne. What many of us experienced was his extraordinary personal warmth, his generosity, his calmness under pressure, his scientific acumen, and his dedication to work, which helped move the Institute forward and contributed greatly to our understanding of infectious diseases in all of its global implications. I and many of my colleagues have found it a most extraordinary honor and a privilege to have worked with John, and I'm glad that we can remember him and his achievements, not only through this lecture program, but also we have about 45 minutes ago dedicated in Building 33, which is the C.W. Bill Young Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases and Biodefense, the John LaMontagne Conference Room. And so when younger people pass through our programs, they will be reminded of a most extraordinary man, John LaMontagne, not only through this lecture series, but when they go to Building 33, which will be the hub of our intramural program for emerging and reemerging infections and biodefense, they will see his picture with his smiling, warm face that was so important to so many of us, and they will know that John LaMontagne was one of the most important people that this institute has ever employed. Now, today, we are pleased that several members of John's family can be with us today. His wife, Elaine LaMontagne, is here, his brother, Greg, and his wife, Carolyn Foote, his sister, Molly Lind, and her husband, Norman, his niece, Melanie Develin, and his good friends and neighbors, John and Morella Belchi. And we welcome all of you here today. Now on to our speaker. And it is most fitting that we have this speaker today, a renowned infectious disease expert, Dr. Michael T. Osterholm, who happened to have been a very good friend of John LaMontagne and was a partner of John's in this quest for making sure that we pay attention to the threat of emerging and re-emerging infectious diseases. Michael is the director of the Center for Infectious Diseases Research and Policy, known as CIDRAP, at the University of Minnesota. In addition to his role in the center, Dr. Osterholm also serves as the associate director of the Department of Homeland Security's National Center for Food Protection and Defense, and is a professor in the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. He has been an international leader in explaining the threat of an influenza pandemic and in detailing the steps that the nation and the world must take to best prepare for such an event. From 2001 to 2005, he served as special advisor on bioterrorism and public health preparedness issues to then Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson. And last summer, HHS current Secretary Michael Leavitt appointed Dr. Osterholm to the new National Science Advisory Board on Biosecurity. An epidemiologist by training, Dr. Osterholm served for 24 years with the Minnesota Department of Health, where he led numerous investigations into infectious diseases in a variety of settings. He's the author or co-author of more than 300 journal articles, and he also wrote a New York Times bestseller on the threat of bioterrorism. He's written numerous articles on influenza pandemic preparedness, including important papers in the New England Journal, Foreign Affairs, and Nature. He's a member of the Institute of Medicine and a fellow of both the American College of Epidemiology and the Infectious Diseases Society of America. Dr. Osterholm joins us today to speak about the challenges in preparing for a potential influenza pandemic. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Michael Osterholm.
Thank you, Tony, for that very, very kind introduction. Let me begin first by saying how truly humbled I am to be here today. To be anywhere in the shadow of John LaMontagne was by itself instilled a sense of greatness. But to be here with so many friends, and most of all with John's family, is an honor that I must say is the highlight among all of those in my career. Let me first of all begin by saying how glad I am to be here to Elaine personally. For those who don't know Elaine, she not only was John's best friend, but lifetime companion. And today, as much as John isn't here with us, I feel him here in Elaine's presence. And I think with the rest of the family here, Greg and Carolyn, Molly, Norman, Grace, we too are very fortunate to have you here with us today to celebrate a very great man. I also would like to acknowledge a number of other people in the audience who I've had the good fortune to spend time with. First and foremost is Tony. You know, there's only two people in the world, actually three, I guess you could say, that you can start out by saying Bono, Oprah, and Tony. And they all work. But the part that most people don't know about is someone who has been mentored, who has been friended by, who has been counseled by. Tony, thank you very much for this invitation. And you and John were not together by accident, and I think that John's work with you spoke as much about you, and you with John spoke as much about him as I could ever imagine. I'd also like to acknowledge a number of other NIH folks here, particularly those who are my grant managers for all those years on my R01. Thank you. You did a great job. Keep it up. But let me move on and talk a little bit about John, as just in a brief sense. John was a very, very dear friend. I got to know John many years ago. As it so happened that my office mate at the Minnesota Department of Health was the person in 1976 who discovered the first cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome associated with what became known as the swine flu situation. As a result of that, I actually got quite involved with that situation, and as such, ended up having conversations with this guy, John LaMontagne, at the NIH way back in the 70s. Our common love of the flu took off at that time. Then, in fact, as I did have my funding through the NIH and as John rose through the ranks to become director of microbiology and infectious diseases, that's where my grant sat. And because I'd gotten to know him, he often would provide very timely and sometimes overly honest advice to those who were working with me as to how to work with me. As a dear friend, of course, he did that. And then, in addition, we both served together in a role that was one that I, to this day, feel very honored and cherished to have shared with him, was we were both on the Board of Scientific Counselors at the National Centers for Infectious Disease at the CDC during the early 90s when the emergent infectious disease issue really took hold. And it was together that we often worked on the issue of emergent infections. And because L for Lyell-Montagne, O for Osterholm were so close together, we always sat next to each other at the meetings. That made for also a lot of interesting side chatter. It was also a very fond memory in November of 2001 when the country was scurrying around responding to the world of bioterrorism that actually both John and I had the good fortune to attend a meeting put together by my very dear friend Stuart Simonson down at the Humphrey Building at HHS. And that day, Alfred Crosby, who was the first author of the 1918 books and a very lively character, came in to talk to us about pandemic influenza. And even then, in the midst of all the bioterrorism, we never lost sight of the importance of pandemic flu. And I can remember very well sitting next to John at breakfast that day and his absolute resolve that we must be better prepared for pandemic influenza. And then it was just spending time with him in general that I will never forget. I won't forget, for example, the morning in 1986 when I got a phone call early in the morning at my home from John to congratulate me on the fact that the Minnesota Twins just the night before had won the World Series. And I realized what he really wanted to talk about was the 1979 Pirates, because he remembered so well how good he felt the next morning after they won the World Series. So I listened for the next 15 minutes about the Pirates winning the series. I could go on any number of things, but that's the man you see there. That's the man who we all came to love. As we are here to pay honor to him today, I tried to find a number of descriptors for him, none which do full justice, but these were all ones that individuals have shared with me or that I think really carefully describe the man we know as John LaMontagne. He was clearly very smart and wise. He was admired and loved. I knew a few people in this business that genuinely were loved. He was very loyal and dedicated. The NIH has never had a better soldier. He was a gentleman. In every instance, it didn't matter what setting he was in. He could be in front of a congressional hearing where they were trying to basically create a new orifice for him, and he was still a gentleman. He identified hot and emerging issues long before they became fashionable, and he acted on them. He was very committed to the future, and he never lost sight of that in all the work that he had before him. And God, he loved Elaine and his family, including the dogs. And as somebody who has three dogs, John and I shared that too. You don't understand the world till you love a dog. And finally, he cared deeply about paying it forward. This institute was for him a way to provide for the next generation, and that was a very important task for John. And for those of us that knew him well, he took more congratulatory comfort, you might say, in watching a junior person do well and never once wanting credit for himself, just understanding how important that was. And last but not least, and hopefully a tone that I will share today with you, in never holding a candle to what John did, he was always truthful, even when it was tough. And sometimes today in the world of science and public policy, being truthful is not an easy thing to do, even when you're not telling a lie. As Tony made comment earlier, I have been on the edge, you might say, about this issue of pandemic flu. Some have put me in the case of the Chicken Little or the scaremonger, depending on where you come from. But in fact, today I want to share with you why this is an issue that we will definitely deal with sometime, somewhere, somehow. Originally, some of the points that I put down now I feel very confident have actually been, you might say, at least understood or heard. In this article published a year ago, in which we tried to talk about the fact of what would happen if a pandemic began tonight. What if it was a year from now? What if it was 10 years from now? What would we need to do? Well, let me say we have made progress since this particular paper was published a year ago. I give a lot of the credit to the Department of Health and Human Services and the various groups, and Stuart Simonson, who's here with us today, deserves a lot of that credit for having kept this issue on the agenda. Also, as you heard in the introduction, I had the chance to serve with Secretary Thompson. Not many secretaries, as they're closing out their tenure at their final press conference, would sit there and say that the one thing that keeps them up at night is, in fact, pandemic influenza. In addition, I think Secretary Mike Leavitt has become an incredible spokesperson for this issue. as Ted Koppel once described, and he's never seen a Washington bureaucrat in a kind way, of course, who is more honest about what the future might hold and what this may mean to our country. And I think that we've been very fortunate. But today I'd like to go a bit further. There's that old adage, you creep, you walk, you run. 5 years ago, we weren't even on our hands and knees. We're walking today, but we need to run. And last week when the president's new plan was issued, I must say that I was one of those that hailed it as a great step forward, as opposed to some who felt it wasn't enough. We must understand where we've been, where we're at, where we're going, and I believe that this is a great way to go. But we've got a lot more to do, and we can't rest on where we've gotten. It must be where we're going to go. Our job must be to minimize the mortality, morbidities, and social, economic, and political disruption that's going to occur with the next pandemic, a pandemic that is going to come. I also have to say, as a moment of disclosure here, and for some of you this may be enough as an excuse to get up and walk out, I do know a lot less about influenza today than I did 30 years ago when I first started teaching graduate students. I knew a lot more. I understood it a lot better. And everything that I have come to know over the last few years tells me I was very naive and only knew a little bit of what I thought I knew, and in some cases, didn't know what I was talking about at all. What I'd like to do today is review really four areas with you. Pandemic influenza lessons learned and revisited. First, what can past pandemics tell us about the next pandemic? What can past pandemics not tell us about the next pandemic? What do we need to know about the influenza virus and infection in animals and humans that inform us about that next pandemic? And finally, what must we do to move to the next step of preparing for that next pandemic? Well, first of all, in terms of what past pandemics tell us about the next pandemic, let me just start out with a very brief story. A year and a half ago, when the New England Journal of Medicine asked me to write a review article on this topic for the journal, I went back to a number of different sources to look at the historic nature of pandemics. And I went to a very prestigious textbook of infectious diseases, and I took the chapter out on influenza. And in there, they noted a historical perspective of influenza, included the number of past pandemics. So I contacted the author and said, you know, where did you come up with that number? And he said, well, the previous author had it in the chapter, so I took it from him. So I called that author and I said, where did you come up with that number? And he said, well, I got it from the first author, whoever wrote that chapter. I just used it from him. So I went to the first author and he said, well, you know, I think this guy gave it to me. So I went to that guy and that guy said, well, you know, I don't know if that's the right number. I always thought that was the number. That today is a number that stands in one of our most prestigious textbooks in the country. And what I soon learned is that in the era of modern science, we have forgotten much about our history. We have forgotten a lot about our history. And we take a lot of it for granted, or we just take a lot for assumption. And so today I'm going to try to share with you, because one of the colleagues who has become very near and dear to me and frankly has taught me a great deal about this business is not another public health person. It's not someone from the medical research area. It's a historian, John Berry. And I've learned a lot about what I didn't know that was buried back as fact in our history. And so I would try to share that with you. First of all, what we have to understand in this debate today is H5N1 going to cause a pandemic or not? What everyone fails to realize, it's not a debate about if we're going to have a pandemic. We are. Pandemics are like earthquakes, hurricanes, and tsunamis. They occur. And we will have another one. Unless there is some magical reason that you can put a tarp up around Minnesota and keep winter out, I can't imagine that we can find a way yet today to keep pandemics from happening again. There's often this sense that we're due a pandemic, that somehow one must occur because it's been X years. In fact, let me just say that while it has been some years since the last pandemic, 1968, 37 years, and the fact of the matter is that during the last 300 years, there have been an average of pandemics every 24 years for a total of 10. Some people say, well, we're due one. It's 37 years, 24 years. That's not true. Anybody who understands what we call probability, as opposed to a normally distributed probability, this is a Poisson distribution. Remember those three 100-year floods that occur all in 10 years? Or the fact that you have cities that hadn't been hit by a hurricane in 50 years, last 2 years, who got hit 2 years in a row. So the point of it is, we don't know when the next pandemic's coming. It could be much longer than the normal 24 to 37 years. That's not the reason we're concerned today. The reason we're concerned today is because we know one is going to come someday, like a hurricane, but because H5N1 sits there rearing its ugly head at us. Now, I must tell you, I do understand that history does pose some challenges sometimes. As George Santayana once said, those who cannot learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And right behind that, George Bernard Shaw said, we learn from history that we learn nothing from history. So I don't know what history is telling me, except I know we're going to have more pandemics. I don't know when it's going to come, but I do know H5N1 should be a reason to think that it might be around the corner. In addition, if we look at this, 1918 was an aberration in terms of pandemic severity. A lot of people think today that those of us in public health glum on to 1918 because it's hoary, it's scary. It's our worst case scenario. Let's, grab them. When in fact, what we have to understand, there have been a multitude of different kinds of pandemics dating back to history when Hippocrates described the very first one. And if one goes back in history, 1918 is not alone. It is not. In 1580, a pandemic of influenza began in what is today the Guangdong province of China. Within 6 to 8 weeks, it's made its way to what is now Turkey. And within 6 weeks, it wiped through all of Europe. 9,000 of the 80,000 residents of Rome died in less than 1 month. Cities in Spain were considered totally depopulated. 1918 wasn't all by itself. It's what our modern mental history can remind us happened. Point being is that I think we have a lot to learn. There have been mild pandemics and there have been severe pandemics. And today, none of us can predict what the next pandemic will be like. Fourth, no two pandemics are alike. That obviously follows off of the comment that I just made. As we go back and begin to look at pandemics, it's not just how severe they were. In the 1890 pandemic, it's very likely that the most severe impact was experienced in a third wave of illness. In 1918, it was a second wave of illness. In 1957 and 1968, it was the first waves of illness. So today, when we make our public health plans or we make assumptions about what the next pandemic might mean in terms of how we respond, just be aware that we don't know what's going to happen. And as I think we go back further, we will realize that pandemic influenza will do whatever she damn pleases. Fifth, the role of non-pharmaceutical interventions. This is one today that is taking on a great deal of life. And it is because we as humans must have a lifeline. That's normal. That's expected. I'm human. I want my lifeline. I want my family to have a lifeline. And we know that vaccines and antivirals are not going to get us out of this one if it happens anytime soon. So what's the next best thing? Let's go find what else we can do, and hopefully that will do it. And we want to look at this carefully. We want to look at this as scientists. We want not just to dismiss it, nor do we want to embrace it. And I'll just tell you that today, there have been some very careful and thoughtful reviews of what we know and what we don't know by this term, non-pharmaceutical interventions. These are the things like quarantine, social distancing, border and institutional closings, even a term called protective sequestration, or the ability to basically lock out the world for a long time. Howard Markel and his colleagues at the University of Michigan, through research funded by DITRA and the DOD, actually went back and did an exhaustive review of 7 communities that supposedly made it through the 1918 pandemic with only a minimal number of cases. And in a very well-done study, they came up with one single conclusion. That is, unless you could practice protective sequestration, the idea of shutting everything off, borders, walls, miles high kind of thing, you could not make a difference. They found no evidence that any of the other social distancing, quarantine, or any other kind of respiratory etiquette practice made any difference. This finding is not inconsistent with the findings of a comprehensive literature review that was done over the past 40 years by the RAND Corporation as part of a contract that Mr. Simonson had put forward to give a better understanding also of a more modern review of all non-pharmaceutical interventions. And again, they came back with the same conclusion. There was no evidence that these made differences. Now, I want to be clear, I'm not saying that they don't work, because, in fact, they may not have been studied sufficiently. But there was no evidence that they made any difference. Finally, John Berry actually has described quite nicely what Australia did in 1918, where they did basically use countrywide protective sequestration, you might say, of trying to shut its borders. Well, of course, it was more like a screen door. It leaked. but it didn't leak enough so that they, in fact, postponed the third wave of the disease for their second wave of the disease, meaning they missed the second wave. By the time it got there, we were worldwide into the third wave of the disease. And as such, Australia did have a reduced mortality associated with that situation. I can't imagine almost anywhere in the world that could do that today, given our global world as we know it. There have been experiences in Hong Kong with SARS where it was suggested that because of the minimizing of physical and social contact, that the other infectious agents, other than SARS, other respiratory agents were decreased at a time when things like hepatitis B were not decreased. As one looks at that closer, there may be some suggestion that social distancing may play some role, but even that is suspect. Now, I bring this up because I worry today we are so interested in finding the answer. We in a modern world want the silver bullet, that we will buy anything from anybody that tells us it will work. We can't, as public health officials, as researchers, allow that to happen. Our bottom line message, as John did so well, we must tell the truth. And the truth is, we don't know if they'll work at all. For example, school closings. I have had very close personal experience with school closings. In the state of Minnesota, one of the largest outbreaks of meningococcal meningitis occurred in one of our communities under my watch as state epidemiologist. We launched a major vaccine campaign in that community, the single largest single campaign ever undertaken in the community. We vaccinated over 30,000 people in one weekend. But what we had happening was a situation where we knew these cases had had their exposure, a single saliva exposure in a social setting that we couldn't talk about publicly as such. But we had a good idea where these kids were getting it. But we had so many parents who took their kids out of school because of fear, even though we said this is a safer place to be. We have photograph after photograph after photograph of the next 4 to 5 days in the city mall, 12 kids all sitting at the one McDonald's with one cup of soda, sharing it with each other as they did their other things not being in school. And so one of the things you have to understand is that just because we take an action doesn't mean that the reaction means things are better. We in public health have to be very aware of that. I often wish I could share this information with John and say, so what would you do? What does this mean to you? And I would always know that he would have an answer. What do past pandemics do not tell us about the next pandemic? Well, first of all, we are in totally uncharted territories with H5N1. Nobody knew that we had a virus that one day would actually be lethal to migratory birds. We have people who believe they know a lot about this. I would suggest that we all have to be very humble. Last fall, I was lecturing at a major international meeting on wildlife veterinary medicine when I suggested migratory birds would play a key role in moving this virus, not to minimize the world of poultry. And a very prestigious international veterinarian got up and, in his very academic way, looked at me and said, I'm sure, Dr. Ostrom, you'd agree that dead birds don't fly over the Himalayas. Within 6 weeks, we knew we had infected birds flying over the Himalayas, exactly the Himalayas. The point being is today is that all I can tell you is the more we learn about H5N1, I think the less we know about it. And we have to understand that, embrace that, and acknowledge that. If there was ever a time of research and discovery, it's now, because it's telling us a great deal about a lot of things. Do I know whether H5N1 will become the next pandemic strain? I don't have a clue. Do I think it's sure a possibility? Absolutely, yes. What we're seeing happen with this ongoing change in the virus is possible. Where do I take some of my thoughts about that? Look at the story of H3N8. H3N8 was a virus that in 1963 jumped from birds to horses. Anyone in the equine world knows all about that because it was a very serious cause of morbidity and mortality before a vaccine was developed. It merrily went along in that horse population until 3.5 years ago, when for reasons yet unbeknownst to any of us, and it was not a classic reassortment, that virus jumped to dogs. And today, canine influenza with H3N8, the horse virus, i.e. bird virus, is a very important disease-causing issue right now in the canine world. Now, why did it take that long? What was the pressure that finally allowed it or permitted it or made it jump from horses to dogs? So every time I hear, and I just was at a medical meeting this weekend when a very prominent physician got up and said, look, if H5N1 was going to do it, it would have done it by now. That is not an answer. And that is, in fact, one of the things we have to continue to remember. I don't know if it'll ever do it, but it could be 3 years from now. It could be 5 years from now. And if it does it, it's different enough that we must all be concerned. Do any of us have an idea how or where it'll begin? No, we don't. As we look back on 1918, it's fascinating what happened. John Barry, in a paper that's currently submitted for publication, has gone back and very, very nicely detailed that there was actually a Herald wave and work that was done here at the NIH which supports this issue that did occur in the spring of 1918, but it didn't occur in Kansas. It occurred all over the world. So that when, in fact, in 1918, the fall of, that virus emerged, it emerged not from one single node or mother lode of virus. It looks like now it literally grew up and emerged out of many locations about the same time. And even those, for example, who want to suggest that in 1918 it was the squalor conditions of World War I that allowed that virus to become the virus, fail to realize the very first country decimated, quote-unquote, in terms of severe disease in all of Europe was Switzerland. Just nobody paid any attention to it, and it was weeks later that, in fact, it hit the trenches of France and Germany. So that one of the issues I think we have to understand is we don't have a clue where this virus will start, the next one, or where it'll begin. What impact the next pandemic will have in terms of morbidity, mortality, and social, economic, and political disruption, I don't know. But I would suggest to you today that we are more ripe for major disruption and major issues than we've ever been in all of our history. And you can say, well, that doesn't make sense. We're in a world of modern science, modern medicine. Why do I say that? Because we as humans have never been more vulnerable. Today in the global just-in-time economy, which I'm going to come back to in a minute, we count on just about everything from somebody else. We don't have anything that we're self-sufficient with. When I look at that issue, look at SARS, 8,000 cases, 800 deaths. In the big picture of infectious diseases, while it was a hot issue for some time, when you look at the big picture, it really only had a limited morbidity mortality impact in this world. Yet when you look what it did to the economies of Asia and what it did in cities like Toronto, it shut them down. It created fear and panic second to none. I'll come back to that. So I don't believe that today the morbidity and mortality of the next pandemic will necessarily dictate how severe we recognize it to be. Again, I wish so much John was here. I'd really, really, really welcome his counsel on this issue. What do we know about influenza viruses and infections in animals and humans? Well, again, I would only reiterate what I said a moment ago. Our findings both at the bench and in the field confirm how little we really know about influenza virus. Remember when it was all about hemagglutinins and a little bit about neuraminidases? Now it's non-structural genes. Now it's all, I mean, everything is becoming part of the milieu of what's critical in terms of this. Is it really about the host? Is it really down deep in the lungs those receptors are at? What does that all mean? What role does the bird really play? Is it possible that, in fact, as Jeff Taubenberger, who I think is one of the heroes of modern fluology, has shown us, as he did with the 1918 virus, that, in fact, you know, it doesn't have to be that classic reassortment. And when we talk about the 1918 virus being a bird virus, I think some people assume it just jumped from birds to humans. We don't know that. Maybe that's the case, and I only hope that Jeff's work, now that he's moving the NIH, can further clarify that issue. But I will tell you right now, maybe it went through another animal species before. Maybe this cat issue is really important. Maybe, in fact, that avian strain is going to get to humans, but via a route that is really one of birds to cats to humans, or any of the other 40-some different species of animals we now realize are very well infected with this virus. So the point of it is, I think we all have to take a dose of humility and step back and say, you know what, we've got to really look at this research agenda. And if there was ever an infectious disease for which we thought we knew so much and actually really knew so little, now is the time that we have to address these pieces. What makes it possible for the next avian influenza virus to become the next pandemic strain? I can tell you, and I'm not a virologist, so I can say this with stupid humility, I don't know. And every virologist, even when I get them all around at the bar at 1 a.m. in the morning, can't tell me that they know either. That's very humbling, again, remembering that what we were where we were 20 years ago and we thought we had this thing pretty well understood. Again, that has to be kept in mind as to where we go in the future. If John was here, I'm sure he would have a very well-scripted research program for us to follow. one that would begin to answer these questions. And I'm happy to say that his legacy at NIH obviously is part of the fact that that script is being written and that we need it desperately. So let me move to the end here and say, so what is really preparedness we need for the next pandemic? What is our end game? What are we trying to do? Well, I think we'd all probably agree that, in fact, the thing we really want to do is reduce morbidity and mortality and social and political and economic disruption. But how are we going to accomplish that? At this point, I would suggest to you, and I'm going to comment on vaccines in a minute, that the reliance on public health interventions or those kinds of things that have now been known as non-pharmaceutical interventions, we must be very careful about not to grab for the magic bullet. I see the trend happening. I see people at policy levels. I see people in public settings where they want to offer somebody something suggesting that you can do that. I have a federal document, not from HHS, which actually says that if you stand 3 feet away from someone at work, you will protect yourself against transmission flu, and at 6 feet, it's even better. I have no concept of what that means. I don't believe that to be the case, as having participated in the recent IOM committee that reviewed the reusability of respirators and masks and carefully looking at the data on transmission, I cannot accept that it is only particle droplet transmission, but that, in fact, airborne does exist. That kind of social distancing will mean little in that setting. The second area, which I assume will be somewhat controversial, but it is in the heart of hearts, I must say that. I say this not to suggest that I have any great knowledge here, but having had 30-some graduate hours of statistics, having had 3 doctoral students who actually did modeling for their PhDs as one of my advisees, I do know a little bit about models. And today I must tell you, we have a hell of an epidemic going out of modeling. And I worry desperately about that because I see precision being put to paper that is far beyond its just desert. We are making conclusions about major public policy positions and approaches to protecting ourselves when in the first instance the emperor has no clothes. And I worry desperately about that. Now, I don't want to suggest that all modeling is bad. Modeling can be helpful and informative. But today, anybody that really believes we can put a fire blanket by using some antivirals in some distant country, I also have a bridge I'd like to sell you. Unfortunately, that is driving international policy right now, and I think diverts us off of what we must do when, in fact, that's not going to work. In addition, it's not going to work not once, but twice, but 3 times. I worry about that desperately, that we, in fact, are beginning to look for silver bullets that don't exist. We will miss the real issues. Vaccines. I worry desperately about the future of pandemic influenza from a vaccine perspective, because I don't believe most of us will have a vaccine. I know the work that's going on. I think that the funding that the HHS has put forward is outstanding. But let's just take a step back. In studies conducted right here at the NIH under Tony's leadership, we know today that the yield for H5N1 is greatly reduced, meaning that today the drug companies who are out there trying to make vaccine using chicken egg as its growth medium are finding anywhere from 10 to 40% the yields that they found for H3N2. So right up front, with only the limited number of pipes, the machines, the buildings we have, we can make much less than we could of just standard influenza vaccine, which as of right now, using standard doses of 15 microgram doses, is only about 300 million doses a year, moving hopefully in the next several years to possibly as high as 400 million. But when you cut that in half or lower, we're now talking about a lot less microgram of antigen. On the backside of that, we have a situation where we know today, again from studies funded through the NIH and IAD, that in fact we need anywhere from 6 to 12 times as much antigen. Hopefully, as we get more research out, we find that adjuvants and others will allow us to reduce that. When you start adding these numbers up and you look at what the worldwide capacity is today, I got to believe we're going to be really lucky if in the first year of a pandemic in the world, we're going to be able to protect 20 to 40 million people. That isn't a lot out of 6.5 billion people on the face of the earth. So we got a big problem. Vaccine is not going to save us in the short term. Where's our long-term potential? I believe it is vaccine, but it's not the vaccine of today. It's the vaccine of many tomorrows from now, which hopefully we can fast forward to getting to much quicker than that. It's a universal vaccine. On May 23rd of 1961, John Fitzgerald Kennedy went to Congress and said, we're going to be to the moon by the end of the decade, not because it's easy, because it's hard, because it's what we do in America. And we did it, and it was hard. I believe today the world needs to call for an incredible effort for a universal vaccine, one where we explore the potential for epitopes yet unappreciated, for vaccines that anticipate the future, vaccines that can be given months in advance for H3, H5, H9, H7, whatever. Now, I don't know that that can happen. There's a lot of good research going on here and elsewhere throughout the country, but we need much more. We need a crash program. And do I think it'll be done in time? No. But maybe it'll be done in time for the next pandemic. And then we need, if we have that, to change the world of how we make vaccines. Today, as long as we have this little dribble of capacity for production on the private side, we will never, ever have a protective vaccine for the world. And we're going to need that in this global just-in-time economy. The same is true for antivirals. Today, the issue of antivirals is a confusing one. It's not enough just to stockpile it. I very much support stockpiling the antivirals, and I think we should be. But has anybody figured out how we're going to use them? Who's going to get them? When are they going to get them? Where are they going to get them? What's the timing? If, in fact, H5 does require a very, very rapid administration after infection, or if, in fact, the GI-related disease in H5 does prohibit the kind of absorption that we need, how will they be used? We've got to work that one through next. The issue of virus research is already clear. We need a crash in this issue that, to date, I think has not yet happened. And in a time of tight funding, who in the Congress is going to come to the NIH and say, here's a couple of additional billion dollars, get on it? Yet we need that. I worry about who's going to take care of us. When SARS impacted on Toronto, it was an open window to the first look at what will happen during a pandemic. There, by the time the SARS epidemic subsided, over 25% of the healthcare workers in Toronto did not show up for work. The fatigue set in. The fear set in. Now, on top of that, there was a sense in Toronto, if you did report to work, and some research has been done by several groups there that showed the number one reason you came to work initially was because it was your duty. That ebbed with time. The second thing that was most important is you believed in the infection control procedures that were in place, i.e., you had the equipment. Today, ladies and gentlemen, there are two companies that own the lion's share of the world's market capacity for making N95 respirator masks. They're now operating at full capacity in this global just-in-time economy. They have no surge capacity. We will run out of N95s within days. No vaccine, limited antivirals, and no respirators. I don't know who's going to show up to work. Would you? Would you let your kids show up to work? I have a 28-year-old daughter who's going to be chief resident of pediatrics at the University of Minnesota. She's going to be in the front line. Is she going to show up for work? I hope she does, but I also hope she doesn't. That's a very divided thing to be a professional and be a father. We've got to understand more what we're doing here, and we've got to address this now, not then. The media. We had a conference in Minnesota in February on business preparedness sponsored by our center. Secretary Leavitt came. The companies represented there had over $3.5 trillion in annual revenues, the big hitters. Two sectors didn't show up, airlines and the media. Everybody else showed up in a big way. Today, the media is one of the most ill-prepared of all the sectors we have. I don't know of a single media organization that has a comprehensive pandemic flu plan, what they're going to do to get through. And that spills over in their reporting. Today, the reporting on pandemic influenza is all about finding the four or five contrarians who say it's never going to happen and then pitting people like Tony and myself and others against them. You know, this idea that there's a good guy and a bad guy. There's a scaremonger and there's somebody going to tell you the truth. That's not the reporting we need. We need a much more honest, a much more real reporting. We're not getting it. And finally, how will society respond? I don't know. But I think we've got a lot more work there to understand that issue. when we, in fact, do have this global just-in-time economy that crashes and food is not going to be available. That can of corn that was harvested in Minnesota 30 years ago by Green Giant went into a warehouse and sat there for 8 to 10 months till it came out. Today, that can of corn's in commerce within 38 hours, and there's fields being harvested all around the world to make sure that corn's in the grocery store every day. Amplify that with everything. Amplify that with drugs. Today, 80% of all the drugs we use in this country come from offshore. That includes all, basically, the childhood vaccines. Think about that. So we've got to start working much more on that side of it. So let me just conclude by saying that, first of all, as Gene Kranz once said, failure is not an option. We've got to work towards finding how we can best respond. Harry Truman once said, men make history, not the other way around. In periods when there is no leadership, society stands still. Progress occurs when courageous, skillful leaders seize the opportunity to change things for the better. I do believe there's a group of us within HHS, within other areas of the public health and medical research world that are trying to do this, but we are still lacking leadership across many of the political realms, across the business sector, and across our general communities. If we're going to really be prepared for that next inevitable pandemic, we're going to need to do that. And as Yogi Berra once said, the future ain't what it used to be. Pandemic flu is going to be part of our future. So I know we'll get through this. We're going to get through it. Every generation, every society in history has gotten through pandemic flu. Our issue is how well are we going to get through it. And so again, I'd come back and say, John, what do you think? We really need him right now, but the fact that we're all here today is in itself a statement of what he's left us. Thank you very much.
Well, we have some time for questions, but before I open for question, I want to present you with this plaque in commemoration of your lectureship here today.
Thank you, buddy.
Thank you. So we have a few minutes for some questions. Please come to the microphone if you have any questions, or scream out. Cloney.
I'm sorry, your mic's not on.
Okay. The modeling, I thought you were a little hard on the modeling. There actually is a lot of different kinds of models, and some of them even include observational data, so maybe. But that's not my question. I was wondering if you would say a little bit about the data sharing issues that have been brought up lately in Nature, for example.
Thank you. And I have appreciated some of your modeling. So when we start talking about the impact of closing schools and how good it will be, I get a little nervous. The question on intellectual property or the sharing of information is a key one. I believe the WHO recognizes today that we can no longer have two communities, those that have access to the virus isolates and the sequence data and those that don't. If there was ever a time that we needed to have a wide open, everybody has access to it's now. And I think the pressure is being brought to bear both in this country and throughout the world. And I know that you're going to hear more about that in the near term. But that is an absolute. It has to happen. We're hindering some really important research from being done. One of the other things I would say is that we have had, and to the extent that it's human nature, I understand this, you know, influenza was not a sexy disease for many, many years. Following the 1976 situation, there were people who were in the influenza area that almost wanted to duck and pretend like as if somehow they, you know, had some other things going on besides influenza. And that group has, I think, endured, and it was a small group, has endured a lot over the years, and now suddenly there's this big influx of all these newcomers. You know, I've been in the trenches for 30 years. What are you doing here now? And, you know, that's human nature. I think that's the case. I don't think that's all the explanation for why this is happening in terms of the issue of sharing this kind of information. But we got to get over it. We got to move on. This is far too important, and I think anything our government does to assure, whether it's the NIH, the CDC, or the USDA, in terms of this information on an international level and making certain that other nations are compliant. The fact that there are researchers in this country who are really some of the premier current researchers that can't get their hands on that turkey isolate right now, I think is inexcusable. Yes.
About a year and a half ago, New England Journal of Medicine published two papers, and it was accompanied by an editorial by the scientist we honor and his colleague, Dr. Fauci, in which it was realized that intradermal immunization might be a more effective route for immunizing than intramuscular that we've been using so long. So what is happening in terms of routes of immunization and adjuvants and that sort of thing in terms of vaccines?
Tony, I want to comment. There is research going on there. But let me just make one point that is key. And this is the point I was making earlier, and in a short period of time, I couldn't really get into this, but this is, I think, a key. Right now, in talking to the companies that make the intradermal needles and syringes, we would take months to years to make enough of those based on their current capacity to make those kinds of syringes and needles to even have them available if the vaccine itself were available. Again, we live in a just-in-time economy. Today, we have less capacity for so many things. I just surveyed a number of the major lab companies in the United States, commercial lab companies or those who produce laboratory test kits, and we are actually going backwards, meaning that we have less access or will have less access to diagnostic testing during a pandemic for two reasons. One, more of it's going offshore to Asia, and with the disruption that will occur, basically today, a very, very, very high percentage of the test kits we use in this country originate in Asia. The second thing of it is now other countries of the world are asking for this, and we're getting in line. We'll run out of diagnostic test kits. So in the case of the vaccine, I just want to come back and say, I'm not even just worried about whether we'll have a vaccine. I'm worried, can anybody get it? And we've got to start doing the research on the complete, what I would call cradle-to-grave aspect of any product we use today, and vaccines one of them. So it's okay to have this research going on, but what's going to support it actually being available? You want to say anything about that, Tony?
Well, Gene, with regard to the intradermal versus intramuscular, there are two major dose-sparing strategies. One is that and one is adjuvant. And the results so far indicate that, as you might expect, ID is better than IM, but it doesn't get you over the goal line. So it makes it better, but it doesn't get you the dose that's a feasible dose. We're at that level where the dose that induces predictively protective immunity is still prohibitively high. You get some mileage with ID, but not enough. And the same thing with the preliminary studies now with alum. It gets you up there a little, but it doesn't get you over the goal line. So we still have a long way to go.
And let me again just come back and say that I am making the assumption, and if anyone can prove me wrong, I will be the happiest man in the world, that the vast majority of us in this room will have no access to vaccine during a pandemic. Because today's production capacity in the world is such that even if we had the magic bullet, if we don't have capacity to produce it, it's not going to be there. The second piece I would just make is we also have to be careful about what I would consider far too often an American-centric view of influenza and protection of our society. Because today, with the global economies I just talked about, think about that 80% of all drugs here are used at the NIH that won't be available because somewhere offshore they're experiencing a pandemic. Think of all those things are going to happen like that, that we have now an urgent and a real need to assure that the world doesn't experience a pandemic, not just us. Any other questions? That's good.
If not, thank you very much. And we invite you all to join us for a reception in the lobby outside. Thank you very much, Michael.